Hello, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is The End of Business as Usual with David Berkus. David Berkus is a best-selling author, an award-winning podcaster, and associate professor of management at Oral Roberts University. David's a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review and Forbes. A popular corporate speaker, he's consulted with all kinds of companies, from startups to Fortune 500 companies. He lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Let's welcome David, please.
So, to give you an opening thought through this entire thing, what sort of guides my ideas around this entire book is the phrase that great leaders don't innovate products, they innovate the factory. I mean, this is a city especially built on the idea of offering innovative products and services, newer technologies, et cetera. But those things come from a focus on the people who come up with them. Any organization that started out as one person inevitably grows, and at that point, the founders, the leaders, have to start thinking about the people who they brought on. Because the work of innovation, the work of creativity, the work of coming up with those products and services turns to those people, and it becomes about them. And this is not a new concept by any means. This is not a new concept at all. This is a concept that has been going on for over 100 years. It was true at the turn of the 20th century, right around the turn of the 20th century, for several different industries. My favorite example, actually, is a smaller company. I was born outside of Philadelphia, and so I've become quite aware of the history of the steel industry, which is a wonderful example of people following trends and then not following them well enough and sort of dying off. It's a great business history to learn from. And one of them, there was a company at the turn of the 19th century that was in trouble. Their name was Bethlehem Iron Company, and they had several problems. The first was that they had a stupid name. They didn't make iron anymore. They made steel. And they later would actually change it to Bethlehem Steel. But beyond the stupid name, their problem was they made steel, and they were making less and less of it. See, they were competing to supply the railroad with a lot of bigger Pittsburgh-based firms that would go on to become captains of industry, things like Carnegie Steel, the ones that you've heard of, right? And so they were making less and less steel, and they were facing the very real possibility that they were going out of business. They would have to close the factory down. They would have to lay off all the workers. They would have to watch as the community around it disintegrated. And they decided, like, how are we going to fight back on this? And they invited a middle-aged intellectual with a really weird past to help them. And when I say a really weird past, what I mean is this gentleman grew up as an academic, got in, passed the Harvard entrance exam with honors, got in, you know, with flying colors, and decided not to go. And no, he did not decide to go to Stanford or anything like that. He decided not to go to school altogether. And instead, he took a job as a machinist at a factory. And he worked his way up, eventually becoming foreman. And when he returned to school, he was studying engineering at night while still working in the factory during the day. And this individual, you might have heard of this. If you've ever taken a History 101 class, I have to spend an entire week talking about this when I teach university classes. His name was Frederick Winslow Taylor. We refer to him as the father of scientific management, the father of management in some cases, the world's sort of first management consultant. If you've never heard of him, that's okay. I promise you, you have or continue to implement ideas that he came up with. See, Taylor believed that as we said earlier, great leaders don't innovate products, they innovate the factory. But Taylor believed that competitiveness came from efficiency, and that efficiency came from studying every little step of the production process and eliminating any unnecessary step, training workers on how to do one specific task over and over and over again so that they could do it well, and then incentivizing and optimizing them to do that task perfectly. That essentially the laborers were these sort of unskilled cogs in this larger machine. And in order to sort of supervise them, we needed to create a new tier of person. We needed to sort of create the manager, management. This is where it all sort of started and started to go wrong, if you will. So it all started here. To give you an idea, actually, this is a nerdy tangent, if you'll indulge me, to give you an idea of how specific Taylor believed we had to study the entire production process. He argued, based on his research, that the optimal weight that a male could shovel for 8 hours a day without burning out, the optimal weight of a shovel was 21.5 pounds. I have no idea where he got this number, 21 and a half pounds. And there's a problem with that if you think about it, right? Some of you are nodding your heads like, I can shovel more than that. You probably can. And the idea of 21 and a half pounds is totally irrelevant unless you're really into sort of high-level gardening and landscaping or something like that. But 21 and a half pounds, here's the problem that I think Taylor solved, and it demonstrates his specificity. Different materials, shovelfuls of different materials, weigh different weights. So a shovelful of sand weighs different than a shovelful of iron ore, right? And a laborer is using the same shovel for any weight. Well, that won't do. For Frederick Taylor, that won't do. So what do we have to do? We have to go out and we have to find different, or sometimes make different shovels for every single material, right? Because the nature of the work calls for different tools for each type of thing. That's how specific Taylor got. Some of you are looking at me like, it's crazy. It probably is. But you know what? It worked. Taylor's ideas sort of boosted the Industrial Revolution, right? We moved from that age where things that would take a lone artisan an entire day to create were now being mass-produced in big factories, right? And that brought us to where we are today, although where we are today looks a lot different than where Taylor's ideas came from, right? I don't know. Most of you look to me today like you're not using shovels every day in your regular work, which is good, right? Which is progress. But where we are today looks a lot different than where we were when Taylor's ideas were being developed. But we drug a lot of those ideas with us from the factory to the office, right? If you've ever seen a show like The Office, UK or US version, they both point to the same problem. Or you ever watch and enjoy comic strips like Dilbert, or you ever enjoy movies like Office Space, you realize that a lot of the ways that we're managing and leading the type of work we're doing now are not exactly working. They're a bit more soulless. They're a bit more routine. They're based on ideas that Taylor came up with. They're based on ideas that worked. I don't want to say that Taylor steered us wrong. In fact, I actually think that Taylor, if he were studying today, would be advocating for very different things because he was adamant about studying the work to be done and changing the management structure and the management ideas based on that work. And the nature of that work has changed, and it's changed dramatically. As I actually like to put it, we've moved from we've moved from a physical factory to an idea factory. Most of the work that we have to do today, I would classify as an idea factory. What do we have to do? We don't necessarily make things anymore. We create ideas. We don't assemble products. We solve problems. We work in our heads. We work with what Peter Drucker originally called knowledge work, what I think now is better termed as creative work, because it's the work of solving problems for our organization, for our customers, whatever it is. And it takes a level of mental energy that Taylor's ideas weren't written for. Taylor's ideas were written for brute force, not brain power. And so we have to look at what does the world look like? What does management look like in this new sort of era? And I mean, it's kind of interesting. I'm speaking from one of the epicenters of these new experimentations with different ways to manage. A lot of the examples that are in Under New Management started in companies that are based in the Bay Area or in New York City or a couple in London even, in these bigger cities. But my criteria was that they have to work not just there, not just in whatever the new cool tech company that Business Insider is writing about, but they also have to work in supermarkets or in hospitals. They have to actually be a part of that dedicated shift in the way that we're doing work and the way that work is managed. So I want to talk about a couple of them, because I think what we often look at is some of these ideas look very, very crazy. They look, honestly, not unlike a different shovel would look to a laborer used to using the same one every time. But there was some level of research and evidence behind why Taylor wanted us to use different shovels for different materials. And what I think is most interesting is that the ideas, especially around how to run a company, that are changing and we're looking at these new different ideas, most often have a level of scientific research behind them, sometimes known and sometimes unknown, right? And I'll give you an idea. So one of the very first ones that I talk about is I actually wanted to call it just like the vacation non-policy. My editor insisted that we be more specific and lose the standard vacation policy. I'm curious, how many people in here, first show of hands, how many people in here would actually have sort of the traditional way most companies run a vacation policy, which is you get a certain number of days per year, use them or lose them or roll them over? Nobody? How many have what you would call, okay, a couple, and then a couple people who aren't willing to raise their hands emphatically? Got it. How many would have this sort of what some people are calling them unlimited vacation policy, non-vacation policy, those sort of things? We got a couple of those. The rest of you take no vacation? basically. And that's not uncommon, right? You, especially Americans were terrible at things like vacation. And when I first was intrigued by a lot of these ideas, I looked deep into this policy and I thought it was all about vacation, right? If you know the story of where this unlimited vacation policy ideas came from, my favorite version of the story comes from Netflix, who decided right before they were going public that their current way they were doing vacation policies was that pretty standard one. You get a certain number of days per year. Those number of days, you use them or lose them. A certain smaller percentage of them you might get paid out for, et cetera. Their big thing, though, was that every employee was responsible because they trust their employees. Every employee was responsible for keeping track of them all. And the auditors who were getting ready to take the company public said, no, you can't do that. There's investors, that's terrible. We can't do that for record-keeping purposes. We have to have some level of management oversight. We need a stricter vacation policy. And Reed and the other senior leaders sort of pushed back on this idea and said, well, do we need a vacation policy? Is there anything in the law that says we have to give people a certain number of vacation days, et cetera? At the same time, a really interesting conversation between Reed and several of his employees happened. Essentially, they were pushing back on this idea. They said, you are not tracking when we're working. You're not standing there at the door at 8:30 seeing that we came in and staying there until 4:35 to make sure we're leaving at certain times. We're doing work around the clock on days on. If we're doing that, why do we have to track days off? Pretty simple question. The combination of these two questions is circulating around his mind, and he decides. The auditors and the lawyers come back and go, no, California state law, there's nothing that says you have to have a vacation policy, right? There's nothing that mandates you have to have a certain number of days or those sort of things. They said, okay, cool. Our vacation policy is we don't have one. Take whatever vacation you want. And what I think is interesting, especially in a more higher performance, higher drive culture like the city that we're in right now, a lot of the complaints around the vacation policy, the unlimited vacation policy is, well, now people are paying or taking less vacation. And it was all sort of a con. And when you dive into the number of days that people are taking before and after, et cetera, you find that on average, people are taking about the same. Now, that's an average, and the tails of that average actually extend out a bit further. So some people in an organization are taking way more than they used to. Some are taking way less. The average sort of ends up around the same, which begs the question to me, why bother with this entire deal, right? If people are just going to take around the same, why bother with all of these things? Why not do that old way that the lawyers and the accountants really, really enjoyed? And that, I think, misses the point of policies like this one. You remember the story. The employees are asking the leaders, you're not tracking all of these things because you trust us. Why are you tracking our days off? And their response was an act of trust. Their response was, you're right. We shouldn't be. So keep track of it. Take whatever you need. We trust you. And what we find is that there's a bigger, deeper thing going on there with trust. Trust, as it turned out, we talk a lot in leadership, too, about how do you earn trust? How do you earn your people's trust? How do people trust you? The interesting thing about trust is that it's never earned. It's reciprocated. We see this actually even in studies of playing interesting games. Like there's one amazing study by Paul Zak. He's a neuroeconomics researcher, which I didn't even know was a field until I started researching this thing. Neuroeconomics, science of how neuroscience affects economic decisions. And he's run several experiments where they play essentially what's sometimes called the trust game. Sometimes it's called the dealer game. The game works like this. We have two people. So let's say me and you, we have two people. And then I am, from the researcher, given $10. And I'm told I can give some amount of that to you. And any amount of that will be tripled. So if I give you $3, it becomes $9 to you. I still get $7, you get $9. And then there'll be another round where he has the opportunity to give that back to me. Right? Now, economically, what am I going to do? What's the rational thing for me to do? Nothing. Right? I'm under no obligation to give him any money. And I have no way of knowing whether or not he'll give me any money. So rationally, I should just take my $10 and leave. But that's not what happens. And this boggled the minds of economists for a long time. That's not what happens. Surprisingly, let's say I give him $3 and he gives me $9. What does he do? Rationally, he should take the money and run. But no, most of them give some amount of money back. And this boggled the minds of several economists until Paul Zak actually started studying what was going on biochemically in people and found that the people who were giving money had higher levels of oxytocin, which some people actually call the trust molecule. It's also the love molecule. It's involved in a lot of social bonding that we do. I won't go into the specifics of when it gets emitted, but it is a lot of different social bonding things. What we find is the people who give or have a higher level of oxytocin. When I give to someone in this game, it actually raises their oxytocin levels, which makes it more likely that they will reciprocate back to me. In other words, I earn more trust when I demonstrate trust. So when the leaders of a company say, you know what, you feel like we've been nickel and diming you over all of these different things, including vacation policy, and we want to demonstrate that we trust you, that's what things like this are actually about. And I find it telling that in Netflix's case, they very quickly switched not only their unlimited vacation policy, when that worked, they switched their expense report policy too, to one that is five words long. Act in Netflix's best interest. In other words, we trust you. And this is where we're headed, because if you think about Taylorism, you think about the ideas that were around management that were built on an age where we were managing a factory. They were built on the assumption that management knew better than labor, and therefore it was management's job to make sure labor was doing the work. But in the type of work we're doing now, it's very rare. I mean, how many of you would say that your whoever your supervisor, if you have one, is, knows more about how to do your job than you do? I know, right? Nobody in this room is raising their hands. Most of them are smirking and going, yeah, I know way more about how to do it. So what does that require? It requires a higher level of trust, because the management class, if we still want to call them that, has to trust that employees know how to do their job best and are going to do it. And the manager's job becomes that of figuring out what the barriers to feeling trusted, what the barriers to doing the work, what the barriers to coming up with ideas are, and eliminating them. If you'll indulge me for a second, I'll grab a sip. So we see, like a lot of things, that it's not necessarily about the policy on the surface. It's actually about what's going on sort of behind the scenes. We see this in one of the incidents I was not expecting to be a crusader for over the last 12 months is this idea of salary transparency. Companies where everybody knows what everybody gets paid. We're used to, in a publicly traded company, we're used to sort of certain executives' salaries being listed. We're used to in nonprofits, others. But there's a surprising amount of resistance to this idea of making salaries transparent. And I find it kind of perplexing, right? Because on one hand, I get it. I came up from sort of that era. I mean, I live in a very libertarian area in the middle of the country, so I'm very much sort of like, no, that's my private information. You don't need to. That's what I began when I found these things. And I thought that's what I was going to find, is this is a crazy idea that doesn't necessarily work. And then we dug into the research around what actually happens. The biggest complaint people have when they're unwilling to try something like salary transparency is the idea that everybody's going to be comparing their salaries to other people. They're going to be arguing. They're going to be fistfights and shouts and all sorts of things because one person gets paid more than me, or et cetera. And my sort of rebuttal to that is always the same. That's happening now anyway, even if people don't know what they get paid. Right? There's a long, well-researched model called equity theory. It's been around for almost 50 years that predicts that everyone is always sort of trying to figure that out. We're always responding to social cues. We're trying to figure out the pecking order. We're looking at the type of chair you have, or where your desk is located, or the type of car you drive. We're trying to use different signals to ascertain how much you get paid and compare that to ours. And equity theory actually says that people will be motivated and happy as employees if they perceive that whatever one person gets paid is equitable to someone else. Equitable is not equal, but what I mean by that is, let's say I work a 10, I'm going to make up metrics, I work a 10 and you work a 15. If I get paid a 10 and you get paid a 15, that's okay. But if I work a 10 and you work a 10, I get paid 10, you get paid 15, that's a problem. And I'm going to respond usually in one or two ways. The first way I'm going to respond is I'm going to try and sabotage you. That's the thing everybody's sort of worried about. Right? The second way I'm going to respond is I'm going to slack off and I'm going to start only working around a 7 and hope I still get paid a 10 so that we can sort of restore equity. We're motivated to feel that our system is fair. And it turns out, though, that we are terrible at judging what other people make. We consistently, and this surprised me, we've done several studies on this, asking people to estimate the salaries of their coworkers. We consistently assume people lower than us on a hierarchy are overpaid. And we consistently assume that people higher than us on a hierarchy are underpaid. In other words, that guy is totally overpaid. He doesn't contribute anything because he's down in that role, right? Or in other words, wow, I look at all of the stuff that my manager has to put up with. Why bother to work hard to get promoted? It's really not worth it because there's not that much money there. That's actually sort of what we consistently do. There's a problem with it when you think about it in the context of equity theory, though. if I am really bad at judging what you get paid because I don't know, and I assume you get paid 15 and you work a 12 and I'm 10-10 still, and now you're 12-15, I'm mad, I'm angry, and I have no reason to be because actually you get paid a 12 and you work a 12. Right? These are made up simplistic numbers, but you get my idea. And that issue becomes a problem, and the only way to solve that, because we're terrible at judging what each other sort of makes, is by transparency. Now, that was the initial argument that sort of got me into this idea that, okay, there's something here. It's maybe it's actually worth it because maybe it feels a little uncomfortable, but it's actually moving us all forward, being a bit more motivated. Then you follow down the sort of transparency rabbit hole, and you find yourself staring at very clear data that in transparent companies and in transparent organizations, there's a dramatic reduction in the gender wage gap and in other forms of wage discrimination, which is a really big deal. Now we're talking about a societal ramification. And you find, moreover, that when you have these transparent salary systems, employees are more likely to speak up about injustices they see inside their organization and fix them, which I think is the biggest benefit. Because before, what if I felt like I wasn't being paid equitably, what was my ramification? Nothing. The only thing I could do is something that exerted power in me. I couldn't bring it up with our mutual manager, right? Because then I would get fired or get disciplined for knowing what you made, for finding that out. Even though some interpretations of the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 say that's illegal, I'm not an attorney, so that doesn't count as legal advice, right? So we find that not only on an individual level, motivationally, not only on a societal level with all sorts of different forms of wage discrimination, but on an organizational level, the pay system moves better towards fairness in this transparency condition. You sort of can't help but advocating for it. So why would we sort of be standing here saying, well, it's better if it's secret, it's better if it's a private contract between people? It again goes back to this idea that we have management and we have labor, and management's job is to tell labor what to do, to measure it, and to reinforce it. It gives more power, what economists would call information asymmetry, to that different tier of person in the organization, to the management tier, if these things are kept secret, if only they have access to the information. But again, we face that problem of most of us are not working in a place where we know more than the manager, and therefore we have to step out and rethink some of these ideas. So moving forward, one other idea, and this is I'm going to actually move into this one because I think this affects us far more, and because I want to be respectful of everyone's time. One idea that I think is most interesting is the idea of, I call it writing the org chart in pencil. But what I mean by this is, how many of you know exactly where you are on the org chart? And when I say org chart, you can visualize the lines and boxes and you know exactly where you are. Some of you, how many of you know that your organization has one? Does it have one? You just sort of don't know where it is. Okay, cool. In any case, when I say that, I mean lines and boxes. Now, the other show of hands thing, how many of you know where this idea of the lines and boxes and reporting relationships came from? So it actually came from the railroad industry. A gentleman by the name of Daniel McCullum in Erie, Pennsylvania, running an Erie, Pennsylvania railroad, decided he needed a physical drawing of the different reporting relationships. Now, railroad's an interesting place to start this because a railroad sort of definitionally is a business model that doesn't change all that much. Right? Once you lay the track, we're pretty solid that we're running this line. Right? Most of the lines that we started laying are still there. So essentially, the business model doesn't change that much. The organizations, the reporting relationships, those don't change all that much. But how many of you work in an organization that's a lot like, no, you don't. We work in an organization where the markets are constantly changing, the customers are constantly changing, the threat of competitors, threat of substitutes, all sorts of things are constantly changing. And we work sort of in an economy where we go through these kind of almost binge and purge cycles of adding on employees and then having to lay off employees. And in that, we're beginning to wonder whether or not the traditional org chart based on the railroad is the right way to segment people out or not. In fact, most the unit of work in most organizations used to be the job, and now it's more the project. I'm working on this project for right now, and in 18 months, I'll be on this next project. And the idea that we're doing project-based work instead of job-based work is not new, but what is new is thinking about, okay, well, then maybe I need a different definition of who's on my team than just who my direct report manager is. So most of the time when I've ever been placed on a team, it's because we all responded to the same person. She was our boss, and so we were her team or something like that. even though I'd be working on one project and somebody else would be working on another. And actually, in one instance, in a very long ago past life, I was a pharmaceutical salesperson, and I wouldn't have called any of them my team because we competed against each other for bonus money, right? So these people are on my team because we have the same manager, but I don't like them. They're making my check lower, right? They're my competitors, not my teammates. So we switch to this idea of project-based work, and what we find is that some organizations are treating their chart more and more like a network and less like lines and boxes. And it carries with it all sorts of ramifications for communication, but the reason we're finding this works so well comes from a very interesting social science study that was done on Broadway. And what we find is that every Broadway show ever, right up until Hamilton, including Hamilton, right? This is I didn't have to use to specify that, but now it's sort of a couple Tony Awards later, and now I have to specify. It still works this way today, but it's been this way for 80 years. Every Broadway show has about 6 people on its senior leadership team. Composer, director, choreographer, librettist, lyricist. You don't have to know what they all are. You have to know there's 6 of them. And that begged an interesting question, because Broadway is a small world. It's a community of people who will work together on a project. Then some of them will leave and go on a new project. Some of them will stay. Other times the whole show will be sort of shut down, and so everybody leaves and goes in their separate ways. But you find, after you've worked there for 2 or 3 years, that you end up working with people you've worked with before. And that brought up a very interesting question in terms of how we pick the right team for a project. And two researchers, Brian Uzi and Jared Spiro, wanted to ask, what is the optimal mix of old and new connections for these teams? So what they did, this was long before there was an IMDb, right, database, so they had to actually hand enter everyone in from Cole Porter. The study was obviously done before Hamilton and even before Lin-Manuel Miranda's first one. I'm blanking on the name of it, something Heights. This is before that, so he wasn't in there. But a database, about 80 years of almost every person you've ever heard of in Broadway and a bunch of people you haven't. And their question was really simple. What is the right ratio of old connections to new connections? And the way that they did this is they came up with what they called a small world quotient, or Q score, for the entire network of Broadway in any given year. And they judged the tightness of the network, meaning lots of people together who had worked together before, or the looseness of the network, density versus looseness or lack of density. And they gave everything a number. Now, so let's say I'll actually give this question to you, because I want to see what you would say. So the most dense networks would be sort of a 5 on a scale of 1 to 5. Everybody's worked with everybody before. We did like Cats 1, and now we're doing Cats 2. That's a 1. 5 would be, I don't know any of these people. They're perfect strangers. I've never worked with them before. That's a 5. What do you think is the best number for, in terms of commercial success, critical success, and the creative output of Broadway as an industry? What do you think was the best number? 1, 5, 3, 2, 5. Lots of people going for 5 because I'm standing over here. If I stand over here, are lots of people going for 1? So all of a sudden, how many of you are going for 3? You think it's a trick question. Okay, you're right that it's a trick question, but you're wrong. It's not 3. It's 2.6. I know, right? I was disappointed too. 2.6. Which begs a question. How do you get 0.6 of a person? And I asked that question to Brian Uzi, and he said the most depressing thing as someone who writes about social science I could ever have heard, which was, David, you read our study wrong. What do you mean? You read our study wrong. We didn't study individual teams, hence 2.6 of a person, 0.6 of a person. We studied the entire network, and we assigned a score to the entire network. And I said, okay, well, Brian, what do you think that means? He goes, the lesson of our entire study isn't how do you form a perfect 2.6 team, because the longer that team works together, the more they'll sort of degrade down into a 1 anyway. It's not actually about that. It's about how do you cultivate a network that allows new teams to form, come together, work on a project, and then disband back and different people reform on different teams. How do you treat an organization or an industry like a network that allows these teams to come together, disband, perform, and disband? We love to think of the idea that the org chart determines who's on a team and that the best teams are tried and true. They've been together forever. They're the sort of band of brothers idea. But the best teams might actually be temporary. And are we organizing ourselves in the way we work in a way that allows temporary teams to fashion? Are we still treating the job as the unit of work, or are we treating the project as the unit of work, and we're assembling teams based on that project. I mean, most of us are sort of already familiar with the idea that working by a team is here, but are we forming the right teams to do that work? And when we look at companies that write their org chart in pencil, that constantly sort of refresh and choose people based on their team, some of them choose people, hire them, and don't even give them an initial position because we don't know what you're going to do yet. We're going to find a team for you, and everybody uses the same term. Everybody says they're an associate or they're this or that. Some of them work that way. Others are finding newer models where there's a core, and this is kind of funny to me because Charles Handy predicted it in the 1980s, there's a core unit of smaller people who are full-time employees whose job it is to set the teams, and then a huge pool of independent contractors that can come together. Does this sound familiar, right? Everybody likes to talk about the gig economy for things like Uber and Airbnb, but we're headed towards a much more gig economy for everything. Not because we're just trying to take advantage of independent contractor laws to get cheap labor, but because what we're trying to do is create a talent pool that allows teams to form together a perfectly blended 2.6 team for that project, come together, perform, and then disband back into the ether to that next project. By that token, I think the other thing that I find most interesting as it pertains to teams and networks is another policy that totally baffles me. And it's this idea of celebrating departures. Has anyone ever quit a job? Anyone? So when you quit a job, you usually get one of two reactions. Sometimes you get the cake in the break room or everybody goes out to lunch to say goodbye. Most of the time, you get the security guard and the box. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, some of you have gotten the security guard in the box. Okay, I once quit a job and I got the virtual equivalent of the security guard in the box. I worked from home for a national company, but I worked out of my home office. And so when I sent my 2 weeks notice email, I got a phone call 30 minutes later from my, I guess, former manager. And he called me and he started talking through the process of winding everything down. And I said, you could have, like, isn't there just like an email you could send me with all of this? Because it was stuff on where to give your car and your laptop. Can't you just send me an email with all of this? And he said, oh, no, I can't do that. Your email's already been shut off. I quit 30 minutes ago. And I gave a 2 weeks notice, not a 30 minutes notice. Like, I should still be. And there was, oh, no, you're done. Like, you quit, you're done, right? So it came as a surprise to me to find that there are lots of companies now that are cultivating and treating former employees less like sort of betrayers and quitters and more like alumni. In fact, most of them literally refer to this as their alumni network. Right? Probably one of the most famous of these is LinkedIn, which is appropriate because most other companies' alumni networks exist on LinkedIn. Right? So clearly they have got a good study for how to do one right. But there are several more. Most of all four of the big four consulting firms, don't quote me on that, I'm pretty sure all four of the big four consulting firms have alumni networks. Chevron, of all companies, has an alumni network that actually will bring people back to work on certain projects after they haven't worked there for so long, which I think is fascinating. Accenture will actually have an alumni network that also gives an employee referral bonus to former employees. So in other words, if I used to work there and I say, hey, you would be a great employee for Accenture and you get hired, I get a bonus even though I don't work there anymore, which is like the next level of employee referral bonuses. Why? What's going on with all this? Well, it turns out, again, to go to the work of Brian Uzi, there's some fascinating research on survivability, especially in times of change, but survivability, and looking at the way that a firm sits inside of a network of an industry. And every company exists in an industry, and every industry isn't just a collection of competitors. It's a network of vendors and suppliers, and yes, competitors, but a bunch of regulators and a bunch of other people who are involved in making that industry work. And when you look at that industry as a network, you find that where you are in that network affects your survivability. And what Brian studied was that every company, every entrepreneur blends a mix of what he called close-knit ties and arm's-length ties, right? Or we could call them strong and weak ties. That's another term used in sociology. But close-knit connections, close-knit ties, and arm's-length ties. Close-knit are the people that you always interact with outside of your company. They're the four or five people you always go to. They're the people that you trust. Arm's-length connections are like, just send me a bid and maybe we'll do business together, maybe we won't, et cetera. And some companies manage just by dealing just with those trusted people, and other companies deal with treating everybody sort of the same. Frank, you work for the federal government. That's a company that works treating basically, give me a bid. Whoever gets the lowest bid, you get the job, right? Lowest price, right? So that's an arm's length connection example. Right. So what we find is that the firms that have the highest chance of survivability sit in between these two, that the best strategy isn't to have just close-knit connections or just arm's-length connections, but is to have a mix of the two. And what I think is amazing is that cultivating an alumni network makes this much easier. Because when people quit, they usually don't quit to disappear off to a totally different industry. That happens, for sure, but that's in the minority. Most often, they're going to work for a competitor or a vendor or a supplier or a regulator or someone else in the network of that industry. And if you can maintain that connection, you can benefit not only individually, but you can benefit your entire firm because you're seeing changes, you're seeing new information quicker than if you're just close-knit. And you have the ability to act on that information more than if you're just arm's length. One fascinating study of engineers showed that And it actually makes the case for a lack of non-compete clauses, which is a case I don't have to make in California, which is great. This is one of the few states where I don't have to make that argument. But it looked at engineers and when they migrate from one firm to another. And so if an engineer who's working and filing patents leaves firm A and goes to firm B, you would expect, clearly, that firm B will now be filing patents that reference work done at firm A. Right? Because when someone leaves, it's not like they can leave their all of their knowledge at the door. They take that with them. And this is actually the argument for why we need to kind of cut people off. We need to have non-competes. We need to protect their ability to leave or their ability to take knowledge with them because we don't want it going over here. But that's not what we find in the research. What we find is that firm A also begins to cite the patents and the work of firm B. Nobody left firm B and came to firm B. It's not like we did a trade like in a sports league. Right, just one person from A going to B, still maintaining a connection to their old colleagues, their old managers, all of their old friends, and that creates a new knowledge flow that works two ways instead of the one way that we think. And it's another way that begs this case that we ought to be treating people not as former employees but as alumni, as connections that we can keep interacting with because they're going to help us move forward. Right? And you add on to that things like writing the org chart in pencil. You add on to that the level of trust that we have. And we're looking at, and this is why we sort of titled this entire session, we're looking at an end to business as usual thinking that firms exist to leverage economies of scale and have very clear lines between where one firm ends and where the next begins. And we're moving to a system of networks, and those networks run on trust. And that trust runs on or relies on the fundamental that when there is labor and there is management, there's a lack of trusts. But when they're all sort of together, right, we have to rely on trust. Now, I know what you're thinking. Some of you might be thinking these ideas sound great. Some of you might be thinking, wow, this guy is way too high on trust. That might be the case. I've got a lot of oxytocin going throughout me right now because I'm seeing smiling faces throughout it. But often I get a lot of resistance to these ideas too. I get a lot of people who say, well, why do we have to bother to make these changes? Because the way we're doing work now is working. And every time I think of possibly a very nerdy analogy, but the way we're doing work now is working. Every time I hear that, I think of the same thing. I think of the internal combustion engine, the one that powers, the one that powers all of our automobiles, but the one that powers a decent percentage of our automobiles if you don't own a Tesla, right? The one that powers a lot of our automobiles. The internal combustion engine, anybody study physics or thermodynamics? A couple of you, none of you? The internal combustion engine, this is from rules of thermodynamics, is only 30% efficient. That's not miles per gallon. That's not fuel efficiency. I mean, what I mean is 30% of the energy that's stored in gasoline gets converted into forward motion. And okay, the internal combustion engine works, but you have to start from a willingness to accept that 70% of your potential energy is lost because of the system. So when I think about organizations are really, they're no different. Right? It's not 30% because it's not gasoline, but the fuel running most organizations, it's not brute force anymore, it's mental energy. How do we capture and measure that energy? One of our best metrics for that is employee engagement. Right? And Gallup does a great job of telling us the annual bad news about employee engagement. Right? Worldwide employee engagement hovers at around 18%. Right? Which means 18% of people feel like they're fully engaged in the task, they're bringing all of their mental energy to work. 18% of people report that they can bring their whole selves to work, that they are engrossed in the task, that they are converting mental energy to at maximum levels to value for the organization or for its customers. 18%. So yeah, okay, cool. The way that we're working now is working. If you're willing to start from 18% is defined as working. I'm not really willing to accept that. And I suspect neither are you, otherwise you wouldn't have taken time out of a beautiful day to come hear about these ideas. I'm not willing to accept that for a couple different reasons. One is that I see fascinating examples of ways people are doing business differently, and I see how they're working. And the other is far more personal. I have a hidden agenda. You're never supposed to have a hidden agenda when you're a presenter or speaker or writer, but I have a hidden agenda. My hidden agenda's names are Lincoln and Harrison. They're my two boys. They're 4 and 2. And when I think about work topics, I can't help think about the fact that 15 to 20 years from now, they hit the workforce. And to think that they have an 18% chance of finding a job that engages them, that captures their full energy, that lets them be their whole self, that's pretty disappointing. Now, it's not just disappointing. That's unacceptable as a parent, right? It's unacceptable. I mean, maybe 50-50 if one of them can have a good job and the other can't, right? No, I'm kidding. Maybe if we could get it 50-50, right? That's a little bit better. But if it's unacceptable for that then, why is it unacceptable now? Like, if it's unacceptable for me to say that my kids have an 18% chance of finding a job that's in – why is it unacceptable as leaders of organizations, even as employees in organizations, to say, yeah, okay, only 18% of that's fine. If it's unacceptable in the future for my kids – that makes me think it has to be unacceptable now for somebody else's kids and for our people, right? We started this whole day with a discussion or with this thought that great leaders don't just innovate the product. In order to get an innovative product or service, they have to innovate the factory. And if the fuel running most of our factories now isn't brute force, it's mental energy, every decision we make about policy, about management, and about how we're going to structure and run our business has to start from the place that our job is to capture mental energy and turn it into value for the organization. That looks very different than the rules of management that were written when the job of an organization was to capture brute force, was to capture physical energy and turn it into an assembly line. It looks very different. And we can't be surprised when we stare at things that look a little bit different. They might look like a really weird, oddly shaped shovel to a laborer used to using the exact same one, but they'll work. Great leaders don't just innovate the product, they also innovate the factory. They innovate the factory so that they can get the innovative product. And that's the question we ask ourselves now as we stare at the end of business as usual and the beginning of the next business as usual. What are we doing to innovate that factory? So we've covered a lot of different ideas. We've covered a lot of different proof behind those ideas. And we've broken a microphone. But I still want to ask what questions you have for me. We'll pass this microphone around so we can get those questions done. But I want to sort of transition into Q&A time. Or how do we want to run this, actually? I will hold this one, and we'll find another one.
Thanks, David. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley, chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program is The End of Business as Usual with David Berkus, and now we're going to turn it over to you guys for questions. But David, let me just ask you one question. So how do we each start with this? It all sounds great. How do we start individually?
Yeah, one of the most interesting things, and this is actually a revelation I sort of wish I had while I was writing the book. A book is never finished, it's just published, and then people have conversations once they read them, and you have additional realizations. And one of them that I had is that most of the ideas in the book and most of the things that we're seeing, the new policies and practices that we're seeing now, are not actually ones to think about where do we start in terms of adoption. They're actually ones that are around elimination. Right, so we found that keeping stuff secret was getting in the way, so we got rid of it. We found that nickel and diming people and their vacation policy was getting in the way, so we got rid of it. We found that the org chart was getting in the way, so we got rid of it. So to me, I think we start, whether we have power to change things or not, we start by looking at what are the things that are actually blocking us from doing our best work and how do we eliminate it. One of my friends, Lisa Bodell, actually her whole book is called Kill the Company, but inside of that, she has a recommendation. And Kill the Company is an exercise, it's actually a marketing exercise, but inside of that, she has a management exercise called Kill a Stupid Rule, which is essentially once a week, we'll get together and we'll figure out what are the stupid rules we should probably kill, right? Not all of them will get killed, but some of them might. So we start from a place of elimination, not necessarily from adoption. The good news around elimination, too, is that it's easier to test. In other words, it's easier to say, you know what, we're just going to do away with this and replace it with something more simple. And if that doesn't work, we can always sort of go back to more complexity, right? Because that's what people were used to. It's a whole lot harder to add additional layers of complexity. That takes far more accommodation than just, we're going to try this for a month or a quarter, and if it doesn't work, we'll go back to the way things were. Other thoughts, questions?
A question and a comment. One quick comment on the transparency of salaries. I think there's a corollary I've seen on that, which is that some organizations benefit by having the whole organization vote on who gets what salary.
Yeah, so we've seen that.
One of the complications, though, is, as you say, the upper management, not only do you underestimate how much they're being paid, you way underestimate their perks.
Very true.
A lot of what you say resonates with me because it's very much the environment I've worked in already. I think others have as well, so it sounds right. However, the question is, there are a lot of people not at the professional level who I would consider more just rote bureaucratic workers. And there's a lot of people that are happy just to have a simple job. They come to 8 to 5 with defined vacations, defined holidays, and they're fine. So putting it all together, putting together the professional teams that are project-based with the, you know, maybe some support staff and others that would rather not have such a fluid environment, that's got to be one of the real challenges.
Yeah, and I think some of it is doable. I mean, I'm encouraged by models like these networked organizations where there is a larger pool. And actually, the easiest to adopt that model where there's a core that's used to sort of the traditional 9-to-5 job, but their job is to pick the talent that goes in these bigger pools of independent contractors. Most of those are actually consulting firms and firms that are doing higher level work. So they're the ones more likely to do the independent consulting. My favorite example of this is a company called Eden McCollum, based out of London, now in a couple different European countries, and I think headed to the U.S. I don't think they've landed. I don't think the Brits have come in that regard yet. Eden McCollum hasn't landed. But you see that. You see that kind of mix. And again, not to sort of point it out, but this is something Charles Handy wrote about in the 1980s, this idea of what he called a cloverleaf organization, which was you had people that were this type of person that wanted that traditional stable job with the traditional stuff. Then you had a different leaf of the clover of the organization that were more the independent contractors. And you could have as many sort of leaves as differences as you want. The challenge that we're actually going to run into is more legal and regulatory. We were talking about this a bit beforehand, or I was with a couple people, that one of the challenges is right now we have a very rigid definitions of who's an employee, who's an exempt employee, non-exempt employee, who's an independent contractor, and we're seeing companies play around with those ideas and a need for kind of probably several different classifications so that we can make that work. There are some that are always going to want the comfort of being that traditional guideline of an employee. There are others that are willing to take the risks to see the payoffs, and we don't have terminology inside of a regulatory reason for that. And unfortunately, you know, we see that right now the way that we're kind of doing it is through a lot of judicial reviews and court cases on what counts as this, what counts as that, which is not the way it's supposed to be. It's probably supposed to be legislative. How we solve the problem that legislators don't move as fast as we'd like. If I could figure that out, I could write a whole new constitution. Yes.
I have a further question about the same topic of transparency on salaries.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I did hear about the Netflix company. I don't know how many other companies have gone that route. But also, would you have any idea how popular that trend is starting to become? And then the second question I have is, how do you address the argument that my salary is private information, and I wouldn't expect my company to divulge my address to anyone without my permission. So I think I would feel the same way about my salary.
Yeah. So first, a quick clarification. To my knowledge, Netflix doesn't have transparent salaries. They do have unlimited vacations. Outside of the federal government, which is actually the largest transparent organization because everybody is a G1, G2, G3, et cetera, the largest organization I'm aware of that has them is actually Whole Foods. And they practice internal transparency, meaning it's not public information the way a government employee is, but anybody can look up the salary of anybody else and the performance data. The biggest thing we see in terms of how do we make that shift is that every culture, every company's culture will kind of determine how much transparency we can do. And I don't think it's a rip the Band-Aid off thing where we just say, let everybody know what everybody gets paid. But there are ways that we can kind of standardize it. Because the goal is to make people, to reinforce the idea that how we're determining pay is fair. And the challenge is managing that tension between making it public, make what you would, you know, you'd say is private information, and reinforcing the idea that no, what you get paid, especially compared to everybody else, is fair. What I kind of advocate for and what I see is there's kind of a spectrum or a series of tiers of transparency. So we start from just the idea of not banning people from having the conversation if they want to, which actually this is where I went on the quick little tangent about National Labor Relations Act. There's a lot of different interpretations of law that say you can't do that anyway. So that's the first step, right? And then you see other companies that go to the step of tiering or leveling. So like the federal government or like military, where everybody's paid at everybody has a G1, G2, G3 position, and then we know what those salaries are, that's leveling. We can say, you might not know exactly what someone gets paid, but you know what all of the tiers are, and so you have that sense of fairness. And if you find out what that person gets paid, you have that. The other thing that you could see, and what I see most companies actually do, is publish the formula. So you may or may not know what everybody gets paid, but you know the formula for which we determine everyone's salary. And if you wanted to plug in the variables and figure it out, just like if I wanted to do the work on Google and find your address, I probably could. Doesn't mean I will. But it reinforces that idea that I can find it, and so we can't really necessarily hide because of that. And then you get to the tier where we literally publish a list of here's what everybody gets paid. I think every company's got to manage the tension on that, but I think almost every company can take steps, greater steps towards transparency, because the most dominant thing we have is people feeling like so-and-so is overpaid or underpaid, or whatever system we have now isn't even a trusted system that's fair. It's just you were given a pool of money and you chose to divvy it up on whatever criteria worked for you, not necessarily uniformly throughout the organization. So I think we take that first step and we look at where we are now and where we should step, but it is a process, not necessarily let's just go right from here to putting it all out on the internet for anyone to see. There are companies that have gone that route, but they did it because their culture could do it and could stomach it at that point. I don't think most companies can go that, but I think they can go to leveling or formula or some other step. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. This is a really fascinating topic, and I've read other people who are writing about similar topics, and we tend to see examples from a half dozen or so organizations that I know are really innovative. I come from the nonprofit sector, and generally organizational culture is a little more conservative, in part because of reporting requirements, lots of other reasons too. I was hoping for some examples of nonprofits and social benefit organizations that have been successfully adopting some of these ideas.
Yeah, so I mean, there are. I would have to go to my trusty computer and Evernote file to find specific ones around transparency and those sort of dynamics. I actually think nonprofit doesn't get enough credit for managing an org chart in pencil anyway. Right, the benefit that nonprofit has is that it starts from the place that most of the people who contribute energy to the cause are volunteers. And then even the people who are there are voluntarily taking much lower salaries than they could get in the private market. So they're sort of volunteers. And I actually think business needs to catch up to the idea that even employees in a for-profit business are essentially volunteers. Unless you sign sort of a contract that specifies a period of time, you're essentially a volunteer. You could leave whenever you wanted. So from writing the org chart in pencil, et cetera, we see a lot of those. One of actually my favorite nonprofit studies from the book had to do less with unlimited vacations and more with sabbaticals. I found this really interesting that as a very valuable reward that didn't end up costing as much as they thought, a lot of nonprofits have switched to adapting, having executive leadership, et cetera, take regular sabbaticals. And what they find is not only does that allow them to come back and do the work with sort of a fresh mind, the really interesting finding that came from it was it allows you to stress test the rest of the organization. And nonprofits and social benefits especially have to run pretty lean, but no organization should run so lean that if one person leaves, the whole thing comes crashing down. And things like sabbaticals and to some extent an unlimited vacation allow you to do that. They allow you to stress test it. And I think that's even more important the lower your headcount is per person. So I hope that helps. I can also, if you send me an email, I can dig up a few more specific examples to give you better case studies and that sort of thing.
Thank you. I'm interested to hear, thank you for your talk. This was very informative. I'm interested to hear what you think about companies that get rid of managers completely. So an example of this is the tomato production company in California.
Morningstar. Yes. Wow.
And I've been reading about this, and I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on
it. Yeah. Morningstar is actually a fascinating example to me because to your point about a lot of, especially in this area, a lot of the examples you hear are come from the tech world, come from that world, and you think like, oh, this could never actually work. And then you find examples like a tomato processing plant that runs on no managers. Or on the unlimited vacation side, there's a hospital outside of Ontario that runs unlimited vacation and it works, right? Which a hospital actually by definition is kind of one of those places where you need to make sure there's a certain number of nurses and doctors and all that sort of stuff. Because if you have a hospital without doctors, you have a hotel, you know? So you have that issue. The idea of what I find interesting, the idea of firing the managers tends to go through cycles where people get really excited about it. Usually when, this is going to sound really aggressive and I don't mean it that way, usually when there's a new model to advocate, the current one that everyone loves to talk about is Holacracy. Morningstar isn't using Holacracy, et cetera. And so I tend not to advocate for any one, like let's just get rid of all managers and adopt this one style. In the Morningstar case, it's using different client letters where you're negotiating with every single person you interact with and you have these different agreements and you manage that. In a company like Zappos, it's Holacracy. What I do find is that I think every organization made this assumption that you had, and this goes back to a lot of different work, but that you had labor and you had management and you had a certain span of control, is the technical fancy term, that someone could only supervise a certain number of people before going crazy, and that's why we needed all of these different tiers. And that model is breaking down. Because with technology, it's becoming easier to supervise bigger numbers of people. It's also, we're moving into a place where most people know more about the work that they're doing than does the person that would be their traditional manager. So these forms are inevitable. I hesitate to always, I have a whole chapter that I called Fire the Managers because I love the Morningstar example. There's also, there's a airplane engine manufacturing plant in Durham, North Carolina, which is another very sort of industrial thing you wouldn't expect to be able to do a whole team-based management approach, but they can do it because it can work in all those different formats. But how it gets played out is always so unique to every different organization that I tend not to recommend do this specific thing exactly as this company would because you're a different company full of different people. Morningstar is a great example, though. How are you reading about Morningstar? I'm impressed.
David, when I read your book, I was very interested in the design firm that took an entire organizational sabbatical for a whole year.
Stefan Sagmeier's firm? Yeah. So,
can you tell us about that? Does that work? How can we do that?
I mean, you could just quit. So this is actually in the early days of TED, like right around when they started publishing all of the talks. I think this was 2007. They started publishing talks in 2005. They published a talk by a man named Stefan Sagmeister, who runs a design firm of, I think at the time the headcount was sort of less than 10 people. And what he did was looking at his own life, and I think this actually bears a really interesting ramification for societal-wide. He looked at his own life and he thought, okay, retirement is traditionally 65. I'm going to live for another 20 years after that. What if I just stole a couple years from that time and inserted them throughout my working career? And so as a firm, they decided, if you want to do this with us, we're going to shut down entirely, take on no projects whatsoever, which also means no revenue. So everybody's got to figure out how they're going to sort of survive. And we're going to go on sabbatical collectively. The assignment is not unlike what university sabbaticals are like. You essentially just do something other than what you normally do. And the reason that it works is you come back with that sort of different perspective. In my first book, The Myth of Creativity, I talk a lot about the idea that a lot of disruptive innovations don't happen when experts find the next level of expertise. They happen when experts find a new field to bring their knowledge to and or learn about a field and how it connects to what their expertise is in. And sabbaticals provide exactly that, an opportunity to get a working knowledge of a different field that you either find out you can bring your expertise to or you find that they have insights for your field. So,
well, we're almost out of time. Does anyone else have another question before we close? Well, David, maybe you could give us a quick wrap-up of the most important thing that we can do today. Yeah. When we leave here and how we can put your ideas into action.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said earlier, our guiding thought throughout the entire discussion today was this idea that great leaders don't just innovate the product, they innovate the factory. So much, interestingly, so much attention in the media is especially paid to this area for innovative products and services, and we're not paying enough attention to these innovative things. We hear a couple of them. We've heard about the Netflixes. We've heard about those kind of bigger companies. So the first is just look. There's a lot of different people experimenting with lots of different ideas. Just look and learn from, even if it's a smaller company than you, even if it's in a different sector, there are things we can learn and bring and adopt. And the second would be look for things to eliminate. As I said earlier, the easiest way to start to adopt and work your way to this is usually to get rid of the layers that were built for a different type of work. And you may not actually have to replace them with anything. So these are not ideas around adoption. They're ideas around elimination. I bet there are two or three things that you can already start making the case that maybe we should eliminate or reduce so that we could do our best work. So I would start there in ways that we innovate the factory. We look for ideas from a variety of different sectors, and we look for things to eliminate. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, David. Well, our program today has been the end of Business as Usual with our speaker, David Berkus. I'm Kevin O'Malley, chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. I've been your host for today. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club of California and our audience listening at home. Thank you for our program today. And with this, our program celebrating over 120 years of enlightened public discussion is closed. Thank you all for coming.